This message comes from NPR sponsor Viore, a new perspective on performance apparel. Clothing designed with premium fabrics, built to move in, styled for life. For 20% off your first purchase, go to viore.com/NPR.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I want to tell you about a kids' show. It's called City of Ghosts. It's on Netflix. And I will admit, it is a little hard to explain, so I guess I will start with the animation. The characters are three-dimensional, mostly children. They look a little like, I don't know, maybe like more thoughtfully designed Nintendo Wii avatars. The show is set in Los Angeles, which is where we record Bullseye. And the backgrounds are real places that thousands of people here walk through every day. The subway station in Koreatown, skate parks in Venice, restaurants in East LA. And the premise of the show is relatively simple. It's framed like a documentary, and your hosts are a group of kids who are all members of the Ghost Club. The Ghost Club, as the name implies, gets reports about ghosts in the city, goes to find them, and then once they do find them, sits down to interview them. The members of the Ghost Club are voiced by kids with little to no acting experience, and the questions they ask the ghosts sound genuine because they are genuine. The ghosts and the other adults in the show are also real people, telling more or less real stories. City of Ghosts takes the real world we live in, sometimes a scary, alienating place, and combines it with a plot device that can be even more scary: ghosts. And despite that, City of Ghosts, the show, isn't scary or alienating. In fact, it's the opposite. It's warm, it's inviting, and illuminating. It gives the viewer, whether they're a kid or an adult, a better idea of the world around us without sacrificing our capacity for imagination. That's a tough thing to do, but Elizabeth Ito, the show's creator, managed to pull it off. And you don't need to take my word for it either. City of Ghosts just nabbed a Peabody Award for its brilliant first season, a Peabody. To celebrate, we're replaying my interview with Elizabeth from last year. So, let's kick things off with a little bit of the show's first episode. This scene features an interview with a ghost named Janet. She's haunting a new restaurant in the neighborhood Boyle Heights here in L.A. Janet is voiced by Judy Hayashi. In real life, Judy is the daughter of the owners of Otomisan, a longtime Japanese diner in that same neighborhood.
Well, so my mom used to own a cleaner's. So I would, after school, go to her cleaner's and I would do my homework at the cleaner's until she finished. Right next to my mom's cleaner's, there was a Japanese cafe called Fuji Cafe. All the servers knew me, you know, as the daughter from next door. Sometimes my mom would go, we would go after she was done with work because she'd be too tired to cook at home. And sometimes I'll order just like a rice ball and they'll make it even though it's not on the menu. My mom always, I guess, wanted to do a restaurant. She still wanted to kind of live out that dream.
And because she knew the previous owner, they sold the restaurant to my mom.
What food did your mom used to make that you miss the most?
I mean, I haven't found a place that I was like, oh, this tempura is better than my mom's. I'm biased because it's my mom and I love her cooking.
Elizabeth Ito, welcome to Bullseye. I'm so happy to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
So when you were conceiving of City of Ghosts, you had to figure out how to describe it to someone at Netflix so that they could give you money to make it. How did you figure that out? Like, what did you say to describe this show?
It was a tough one. I think at the beginning, it was saying, like, not over-explaining it, kind of boiling it down to the things that should be really appealing to, I think, any studio to make a kid show, that it's about something that understands... Well, for one thing, it was like programming for kids that was quieter, that came from a different place than other stuff that was out there. So I very much centered it basically saying, like, I'd noticed when I was trying to find things to watch with my son, who's a really sensitive kid, that there wasn't anything, even kind of within the preschool landscape, there wasn't very much that was, like, quieter for us to watch together. So I was looking for something that's similar to, like, the feeling of watching, like, old Mr. Rogers videos, like the process videos where they go to, like, a crayon factory or a place like that. So it was really making it about what I was trying to bring to kids and see things through the way that I felt I would like to see kids, the way kids see things.
Yeah, I do feel like, having watched a lot of kids' entertainment, because I have young kids as well, that the surface take, the first level take, is kids' entertainment is so dramatically better than it was when I was a kid. Like, the difference is absolutely night and day. I can name a few good shows from my childhood that are actually good, like Mr. Rogers and Sesame Street. I mean, The Voyage of the Mimi maybe was good. I don't know. But it's a short list, right? I think Batman maybe was actually good. I'm not 100% sure on that.
But I'm really impressed with the Voyage of the Mimi inclusion. Like,
I was way into that show. I was way into the deaf lady showing tiny Ben Affleck how to gather water with a tarp, condensation on a tarp. And they got stuck on an island. This was maybe a Canadian educational TV show about a whale boat that got a whale science boat that got
crashed
on an island.
Very clear memories of watching that in my junior high, like, seventh grade biology class.
I think I watched it when I was staying home sick from seventh grade. So television shows are much, much better. But often I think the way that they are better is that they follow the kind of Nickelodeon kids TV show revolution of the 1990s, which is that just a lot of stuff happens and it's very arresting and pretty funny, even for adults often, but it can feel a little assaultive. Did you notice your kids, like, having a little bit, like there's something that hooks into kids from that, but it also sometimes can leave them a little jittered by it?
Yeah, I think I also get jittered by it, to be totally honest. Like, I mean, in the most selfish way, I make a lot of the stuff I make for myself more than anybody else. And, like, I honestly get really tired at how fast stuff cuts sometimes. Like, similarly, it's like when your kids are really little, they always tell you, don't show them stuff that cuts really fast because you're going to ruin their brains for the rest of their lives. So I think that was another factor that went into me, like, searching for more stuff to watch with my son, that I wasn't going to destroy his brain somehow. And yeah, there's very few things you can find currently sometimes, even when they're things that are likable, that don't cut really fast to keep up with everything else that catches their attention that way.
Yeah. The show is also about cities generally, and Los Angeles specifically. Was that always part of the idea?
Yeah. From the very beginning, I think, like, in the same way that my short about my brother was really just centered around my personal life, I thought, well, I do want to do a show about the history of LA. And then I think as we started talking about it, there was this realization of, like, oh yeah, this could be broader. But yeah, definitely starting with the idea that LA was a place that was really unique, and I wanted to capture how that is for me, like, why that is for me.
Do you remember seeing shows when you were a kid that were about the city in a way that you related to as a kid who grew up in LA? And I mean the city, like, broadly, not even just the city of LA, but just the idea of cities.
To be honest, like, some of my fondest memories of programming that was really specific to here was, like, Huell Hauser. Like, some of the first things that I remember watching where I was like, that's my city, where, like, he went to, like, a peach cobbler restaurant or takeout place that was really close to where I lived. And
And we should, I'm sorry to cut you off, we should explain Huell Hauser was a local public television personality whose show that he created himself was also syndicated throughout California. And he was a Southern guy with a big drawl who would go to Missions and Langer's Delicatessen and marvel at them in a way that is difficult to describe in its like pure majesty. Like he's truly an extraordinary, like the Mr. Rogers of going around it and pointing at civic landmarks.
Yeah, and he started with Videolog. Did you watch his show Videolog? That was like a predecessor to
California's Gold.
Yeah, that was really early. So like, I mean, it was even less produced.
It's hard to imagine. The aesthetics of the show essentially were him talking to his cameraman while a long unedited shot played of him wandering around an avocado field. And it's absolutely transfixing and delightful in its ridiculousness, but also in its sincere brilliance.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the first and only thing that came to mind. And like, maybe like Die Hard, because they go to Nakatomi Plaza. So, and I remember thinking like, oh, that's in Century City. So, yeah, maybe those are the first two things that came to my brain. But I think, I mean, Huell Hauser and Videolog and all of that and that homemadeness of what he did, I think that definitely had a big impression on me.
I hosted a menswear video show and we had a premiere party for the very first episode at a friend's store in Pasadena. And somebody said to me jokingly, this was 10 or 12 years ago, somebody said to me jokingly, you should invite Huell Hauser to it. And I'm from San Francisco and we didn't have Huell Hauser when I was a kid. So I had only experienced him a few times here in LA since I'd moved. And I was like, yeah, okay, fine. I'll invite Huell Hauser. And I went on HuellHauser.com and found a link and sent an email and he came. And it was like we were at a house party in Vallejo and E40 walked through the door. Like people flipped out. And he's just there and he's like, hi, guys, it's me, Huell. It's great to have everybody here. So tell me about menswear, you know? And it was like, it was like a genuinely magical experience in my life because he really brought that to the world, like fully. I have a voicemail on my phone that I've been saving from Huell Hauser for 10 years. I tried to get him on this show and he passed away, unfortunately, a month or so after he left this call. Well, we were still trying to figure out the details. But there's something incredible about him. And the thing that your show made me think of Huell Hauser because it has that quality, while it has a very different tone, it has that same quality of kind of like open-heartedness to people and places. And that must have been part of what sparked the excitement about making something like that.
Yeah, I think, you know, like there's a lot of immigrant struggle stories and those are definitely interesting and have a place. But I think especially like for making programming for children, you try to think a lot about what kinds of stories are helpful to them. So through that, I think is stuff like City of Ghosts helps where it shows joyful stories, like with some sadness in there, but weaved in a way where it's like, yeah, within these cities, there's so much of a depth of what you can experience.
I spent some time recently thinking about why I cared so much about Sesame Street as a kid. And I mean, part of it was because Sesame Street is a great show. I mean, that's why it's Sesame Street. But it occurred to me that as a kid growing up in the city, almost all of my media was about Back to the Future type kids, like kids who skateboarded from in their cul-de-sac, which had no meaning to me at all, like truly no meaning to me at all. And even though Sesame Street is set in a kind of abstracted version of New York, which was 3,000 miles from where I lived in San Francisco, just the mere fact that it had the sense of urbanity that like everyone was there together knocking into each other was so important to me. And just that feeling of like, oh, this is like when I go down and talk to the lady at the corner store, you know, like that feeling.
Yeah, man. I mean, like Sesame Street, that's totally true. And the early Sesame Street, especially like, but I guess what's now like old school Sesame Street, the people felt not like super shiny. I mean, same with Muppets. Like, I think that's why those are so appealing to me, especially the early ones. Like, there's like a crudeness to it, but it's also still amazing to me whenever I think about Muppets now to like realize how much life they've put into this thing that's like a piece of foam on somebody's hand. Not to like digress onto something, but like I was watching a clip lately of Miss Piggy and Charles Grodin, and you never once think about he's holding somebody's forearm like this, you know? It's not actually a character, but it is a character, you know? Like, it never, yeah, I don't know. It's amazing to me.
Even more with Elizabeth Ito still to come. Stay with us. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu. Support for NPR and the following message come from Jarl and Pamela Moan, thanking the people who make public radio great every day and also those who listen.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on Black experiences. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you're just joining us, we're listening to my 2021 interview with Elizabeth Ito. She's a writer and animator who's worked on Adventure Time, SpongeBob SquarePants, and more. She created the show City of Ghosts on Netflix, which is a unique and fascinating program that tells the story of different places in Los Angeles through interviews with real people. The show just earned a Peabody Award in the children and youth category. Let's get back into our conversation.
Why did you make the choice to make the show substantially based on interviews rather than scripting narratives?
I just really love kind of like improvisational stuff that has to do with like real people and like how we really talk and all the kind of funny stories that people have to tell about themselves and their lives, and finding ways to integrate that into this larger story about the city. I don't know. Like, there's so many things that I don't enjoy as much when they're kind of watered down, like when somebody else takes a story that somebody else has about themselves and they try to write it for an actor or for a character. I just get so much joy out of figuring out how do we animate that particular person's story and that voice in this way that really captures everything that's so great about the way real people tell their stories.
Give me an example. Tell me someone that you talked to for the show and how you thought about how to represent them in animation.
The first person that I'm thinking of is really JMD. Like, he just floated into my mind, so I'm going to go with him because I think when we very first started researching that neighborhood to figure out, like, who do we want to talk to, what kinds of things do we want to talk about that are happening there, I met up with him in Leimert, and he just toured us around, and it really felt like an old friend, or he felt like an old friend. that I just had never known. I guess that's a weird way to describe it, but like, and there's so much about the way that he talks that if you hear him speak and you're from there, you kind of are like automatically connect, like, oh, he must be from around where I came from, like South LA, because there's a way that he talks. So it was sort of just everything about meeting him, and likewise, like meeting most of the people where they became characters in the show. It was like this feeling of like, this feels like exactly what we want to capture. This feels like the right person to play this role. This part of their story feels like it fits into the narrative that we're working on in the show. So instead of finding an actor to act as if they're this person, let's just get them directly. And then, so with JMD too, it was also not only his voice, but then it was important to me, like, is there a way to overlap his drumming into the soundtrack of the show? Because we want it to feel like his rhythms. And then we found a way to make that happen. So I think it was just trying to find the things that like shine to me as representative of these people and putting that into the show.
Let's hear a little bit of JMD from the episode of City of Ghosts that's about Lemert Park here in Los Angeles. In this scene, there's a kid detective interviewing JMD, who is, in the show, a ghost.
What was Lemert like when you lived here?
It was beautiful in the daytime. At night, it was a whole nother life. You know, there's a lot of seedy things going on late at night. It just wasn't good. Jazz seemed to wash all that away. The music changed everything. You see all of these people sitting outside playing chess, listening to music, having coffee, having conversations about worldly events, culture, and things of that. And then all of a sudden, the riffraff didn't have a place. They didn't have a foothold anymore. Nobody said, get out. They just kind of like, this ain't the place for me.
Were you worried about making a show that felt like tourism or anthropology?
What do you mean, like anthropology?
I mean, like, I feel like often when media takes on the representation of underheard voices, often the way that it's done is by giving a cultural tour of a place and describing the people as though they are aliens. And I know that like as a young person, when I listened to public radio and there was stuff about young people, that would make me mad. Or as a person who lived in the inner city and I would hear people talk about the inner city, that would make me mad. And it wasn't even just people who were getting it wrong. It was also people who felt patronizing in their tone about this place or this type of being in the world that was native to me.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've never heard, nobody's ever asked me that, but the easy answer is yes. I was worried about it a bit. I think like my version of thinking of worrying about it was like with Welcome to My Life, my short, I had something that I understood that was easy to like kind of do whatever I wanted with in some regards, because like I know my family so well. But when I suggested the idea of City of Ghosts, I think I was nervous because first of all, there's limitations to what I know about my own city. So there was that fear. And then like you're saying, it's so many cultures that I knew would be outside of my own experience, that I was definitely pretty terrified that I was going to do that, that I was going to treat it like I was some sort of explorer discovering this new thing that I'm introducing people to. And I, there were some times where we did have to kind of have just meetings and stuff about, you know, outlines and where we were going with them in those kinds of concerns.
How did you address that?
Sometimes it was like avoiding going a certain direction. Like for the Tongva episode, we definitely had to take a while to figure out who should this story be about? Like, who's the one who needs to learn something? Who should be the one guiding this character through that discovery? I think it was just a lot of introspective moments of, like, whose voice should be the most prominent in this episode, and who should they be getting their lessons from about where this is coming from? So it was like, I think initially we had started with where it wasn't necessarily driven by Jasper. It was driven by another kid having a question. And then so Akko definitely was just incredibly thoughtful about it. So it was nice to have a director where I could have these, they're not difficult conversations if you're having them with the right person, you know, like they're kind of easy conversations to have if you're talking to them with somebody who's at the same place as you are with what they're trying to do with the subject matter. So I felt that was a really fortunate thing to have people that I could talk to like that.
You know, a lot of people talk about how amazing Mr. Rogers was, aptly, appropriately. We talked about Huell Hauser and how amazing he was, and I was trying to think what it was that led me to connect the two of them in my mind, which they certainly are. And I think for me the reason is that it's so rare to have such huge personalities, such, you know, in Huell's case, like this huge performance as well, but both bring so much to the screen, but they're also so much characterized by their kind of humility. And that seems like, that quality seems so evident in your show that it must have been a choice that you made, that this is a show about listening more than it is a show about telling.
I feel really flattered, so I'm going to take a minute.
Well, I really love your show. I think it's so wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is just that I try to enjoy having kids as much as I can. But, like, part of that is just I'm so appreciative of how funny kids are. And I think some of that comes from having a mom who is a public school teacher, you know, and a good public school teacher, you know, where I knew she really cared about the kids. And I would hear just when she would come home, like, I mean, just how much it meant to her to kind of listen to the kids that were in her class. Like, you know, different kids have different abilities for learning. They have different needs for how they learn, and feeling like she was always really sensitive and aware for that. So I think, like, especially after I had kids, I was like, man, there needs to be more stuff out there for kids to, like, to celebrate how weird and funny and unique they are. And I think my feeling was like, there's a lot out here that's trying to sell them something, but I really want stuff that just genuinely, like, gets them to laugh, gets kind of the weird kids. Like, I was a weird kid, I think. My mom would probably not like that I was saying that, but I definitely recognize some of that in my son and my daughter. So I think of it as a good thing. But, like, I'm really happy to hear that about the show, because I was also really happy to sort of have this feeling that I created a working environment that was similar. Like, I think the people that ended up working on the show all just, like, really appreciated having a show that also, like, listened to the creatives that were on it, where they had this opportunity to kind of, like, not feel nervous if they wanted to question something, or not feel nervous if there was, like, something where, what if we did it a different way, that if they came to me to ask me about that kind of stuff, I really wanted to listen to that and I really wanted to hear it. So, I mean, within reason, like, obviously there's points where you're like, nope, we can't do that. But for the most part, like, wanting to feel like there was a collaborative show within animation that was kind of less of a business and more of, like, filmmaking.
There's an episode of City of Ghosts that's based in Koreatown, which is a neighborhood in Los Angeles that starts about three or four blocks west of where we're sitting right now. And when watching it, I had that feeling that you had when you saw Nakatomi Plaza in Die Hard, which is like, I used to live over there, do the show over there. And like you show, there's a part that takes place in a restaurant that is a block from where I lived. And I'm 40 years old. I've lived in Los Angeles, the most filmed city in the world, for 12 years or 14 years or something. And I work in entertainment. And just seeing something from my neighborhood was so exciting to me. And I thought, why did she choose to make this show's places real places? Because the background painting, so to speak, I'm sure you make it on computers, but the background painting, so to speak, of these episodes are photographs of places. So why are they real places and not just pictures that somebody drew that show the ideal qualities of a certain type of place for your certain story that you're telling?
Again, I think kind of going down this path of doing like hybrid documentary animated stuff, when I first started doing it with my short, the thought was just, well, actually, like if I back way up, it's because I started playing with putting my drawings into Instagram back before they had a lot of stuff where you could just put stickers in or things like that. And it got kind of a good response, and I really enjoyed doing it. And then when I got to do my short at Cartoon Network, I thought, well, maybe there's something to doing something like that, but animated, so that when you're using real voices and you're trying to make it feel real, that you ground it by actually having the backgrounds be real. But I didn't necessarily know if that was like affordable for TV yet, because the only places where I'd really seen that were like movies and kind of like lower budget versions of that before. And then I also just thought it would be a combo of like photos and probably like CG animation, because I want them to look like they actually exist in the space. But also, like, similarly, the only CG animation that I'd really seen on TV was maybe like Garfield. And I was like, I don't want Garfield, but we'll see. Maybe there's somebody who'll give me.
Maybe Odie.
Yeah.
Nirmal might come into it at some point.
Nirmal, yeah. Or Eileen, Arlene? Was that somebody's girlfriend?
Yeah, like John's girlfriend, I think. Yeah, that sounds right.
So, yeah. And then I think when we figured out that I wasn't going to be making Welcome to My Life, the TV show at Netflix, and I was making City of Ghosts, I still wanted to keep that same idea of grounding it. Like, if we're going to do it in a real city, can we then try something different and like maybe go out to those locations that we're working in and not only sort of like research them by taking like field trips to them, but can we then hire like maybe like a street photographer or somebody who's done photography in the city to capture it? So that we're really capturing something from the lens of somebody that understands this place. And it all worked out. So I guess that's how we ended up with real places.
How does it change the show, do you think, that there are real places?
I think in a small but big way, it really allowed us to keep like really neighborhood-specific little details. Like, honestly, just keeping, like, the real texture of the curbs, a lot of it is the lighting. I think even though in some cases we enhanced it or we painted it to sort of favor a certain time of day or whatnot, I feel like there is, like, this very specific characteristic to the light in L.A. That because we were basing it, both using a real photo and basing it off of a photo, I think that makes it feel really, really authentic because it is authentic.
How do you cast children for a show that is this different in tone from most animated television shows that are casting children?
It was kind of hard. but I think luckily from some of the experience that I had on Adventure Time had to do with like recording and who you wanted the voice to be. There were like a lot of things really early on in Adventure Time where it was like, we want people to talk with their real voices. We want them to sound like the people that we're asking to do the voices.
Which is like the opposite of animation voice work in general. Most animated shows have a limited pool of actors who they just bring in for the day to do 25 voices. And that's like the skill that's most prized among voiceover actors.
Yeah. And the pros are incredibly good at it. I was always like really impressed with how I wouldn't know that one voice actor had been all of these different characters that I loved. But like, yeah, for my show, it was like such a different thing, similar to what we would look for on Adventure Time. I really wanted the kids to sound like little kids, kind of like how old Charlie Brown cartoons are. And even more so in a way where it's like I wanted them to not sound scripted. Like I really wanted them to sound as if they were kids that would be shouting these things out or asking these questions. So it was really just saying, okay, first, like, honestly, we couldn't cast real actors because it was like this thing where if we wanted to cast non-SAG people to voice our show, we couldn't cast any SAG people. So that was already a limitation. So it was saying, hey, we need to reach out to kids, but they can't kind of like already be professional voice actors. So that's one thing. And then another was just like kind of watching a lot of auditions of kids and working with a really good casting director to sort of like find kids who were local also to where we were at so that they would sound like the kids that they were playing.
When you say local to where we were at, you don't mean local to Southern California.
No, I specifically mean like local to like Hollywood. I guess Hollywood could be central to a lot of the neighborhoods we touched, like Koreatown or West LA or Leimert. I don't even know how to describe this entire coincidence, except it's just that like we picked the voice of Eva. We recorded her for a few and then we decided to set the Leimert episode at Hot and Cool Cafe. And then it turned out her mom co-runs that place. So she says she's from Leimert Park in the episode, and she really is like definitely from Leimert Park. So yeah, that's one very specific example of like very local.
We'll finish up with Elizabeth Ito after a quick break. When we return, has she seen any ghosts in real life, and what were they like? We'll hear the answer in a minute. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. This message comes from Apple Card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase. That's 3% on products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card, issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval, terms apply.
Hal Lublin here with breaking news on a revolutionary form of entertainment, professional wrestling. For more, we go to our correspondent, Danielle Radford.
Professional wrestling is the craze that's sweeping the nation, featuring fisticuffs and colorful costumes.
But who can help us make sense of this world of body slams? Lindsay Kelk has the answer.
Sources tell us of an amazing podcast called Tights and Fights, filled with discussions of the absurdity of professional wrestling, plus all the sincerity and hilarity that you could shake a stick at.
Listen to the Tights and Fights podcast every week.
Find it on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts.
And your old-timey radio.
This is Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with the creator of City of Ghosts, Elizabeth Ito. Her show just won a Peabody Award. How did you end up having one of the kid characters in the show be non-binary?
That, again, was sort of like a choice based off of kind of like my feelings about how different kids have different lives in different parts of the city. My mom was a teacher kind of on the west side, like in Santa Monica area, which tends to be a little bit more, sometimes a little bit more forward thinking. But it's also just like, so part of it was that Thomas's character is supposed to come from, they're supposed to come from West LA or Santa Monica. And I thought, oh, well, maybe this is an opportunity to have Thomas be non-binary or different in some way that's a little bit more embraced on that side of town. And it was also just a combination of that, plus knowing a lot of parents whose kids are non-binary from preschool. And so thinking like, if this is a choice we can make and it makes sense for that character, let's go for it. And it was really just that. And then telling our casting director, if possible, can we cast for this character, and being able to make that work out, which was really nice and surprising.
My kids flipped out when they figured that out. I mean, I can't even begin to tell you how much that means to kids. And for it to be in the fabric of the show, for it not to be the premise of the show. I mean, the premise of the show is also nice, but it's not a very special episode. It's just that is one of the things about one of the kids. Just as your episode about Leimert Park is not a very special episode about the importance of jazz in American culture, you know, although that can be great. Jazz is important in American culture. It's just that's part of Leimert Park. Like, it was the jazz capital of Los Angeles, and then it was, you know, the home to the Freestyle Fellowship.
Yeah. I mean, I was happy to be able to do a show where most stuff wasn't a very special episode, you know? And, like, I think at the end of it, honestly, just, like, not to be super tooting my horn, but, like, impressed at what we packed in without having done one episode that was, like, where it's a highlight rather than sort of just, like, built in.
Do you think that this is an operation you could pick up and move somewhere else? Or do you think this is something that only works in the context of Los Angeles, the city that you were born in?
I think it could definitely move somewhere else. I'm not sure where, because I have differing feelings about what like the evolution of it could be. At the very beginning, we had some conversations where when it was like, oh, let's just hypothetically say like this show explodes, and then what do you do after for the multiple seasons? Do you stay here and do more stories? Do you go abroad? Do you stay within the United States? At the time, I think I was just so overwhelmed with like, I got to make a show that I was like, I don't know. I have no idea. Like maybe it only stays here. I don't even know how many episodes I'm going to make of this show that I haven't made yet. But I think it's interesting as a travel show. I also think it's interesting as like recently I've kind of wondered, is it funnier if it's like, what if it stayed really adjacent to LA and then the next episode after that was adjacent to wherever that was? And then you just gradually got farther and farther out until it was like way out. Cause like part of me envisioned like, is another kid starting their own ghost club in their city? Like, then do you go to that ghost club? So yeah, there's all like all sorts of ways that I've imagined it.
Do you have any experience with ghosts?
Yeah. When I was about 6 or 7, I saw a ghost in the hallway of our house that we're pretty sure was my great grandmother, because it was like a leap year. And she was born on a leap year. And I mean, she wasn't alive anymore at that point. So that was another factor. Yeah.
Can you describe what that was like?
I used to get really scared getting up to go to the bathroom at night when I was that age, which I don't know why I get so upset at my kids for not wanting to go in their own rooms now that I'm thinking about that. But So I had to go to the bathroom. I went to the bathroom and I was sitting there looking out into the hallway, and I thought I saw like a kind of like a foggy thing. So if you've watched the show, then like it kind of was reminiscent of like Janet, the ghost in the first episode. And so I just yelled to my parents, like, somebody come help me, I'm scared. I think somebody was like, what's wrong? And I said, there's a ghost out here. And then somebody said, go back to bed. So that's what I did. And then the next morning, my dad was asking me about it. And he said he had seen it too earlier in the night, but he didn't want to come out because he was so scared. So he just told me to go back to bed.
That's a powerful dad move there.
Yeah. You know, what's really funny too is his friend recently, a family friend who's lived in Eagle Rock since I was a kid, like since before I was born, maybe. He lives nearby. So I live nearby him now. And he called me to say that he heard me on the radio and or on the news. He heard me on the news and he said, and you know, I got chills listening to you talking about your ghost story because I remember I came over to your family's house the day after that had happened. And I came in and I saw there was a camera. Your dad had a camera set up on a tripod aimed at like the corner. And I asked him, like, what's this about? And he said the whole thing. And he had set up this camera because his plan was to take a picture of the ghost the next night. Like, he had set it up with really high-speed film. And he was planning to, like, try to take a picture of it really covertly because he didn't want to disturb it. I don't know. Like, I thought that was a very funny, like, weird memory of, like, my dad also trying to capture the ghost the second night.
The ghosts on your show, though, aren't spooky ghosts. How would you describe what they are?
I think the ghosts on my show are... they're just basically people that used to live here or, like, kind of people that haven't stopped living here, even though they might not have a body anymore. But they still have opinions and they still have feelings. So they still want to talk to people about who they were and, like, what they did.
Yeah, I think one of the things about living in the city, especially growing up in the city when you have a little more, maybe you probably have more sense of magic and wonder than I do, but you have this feeling of every physical place, a building, every part of the built world, but, you know, other places in the city too, parks and stuff. They have all lived a life that is far beyond your life. And there have been so many lives that have passed through those places in so many ways. And you sort of, you are living with all of those things at the same time in a way. And, you know, American, you know, Los Angeles, maybe that's 100 years or, you know, if you're talking about the Tongva people, you're talking about a 1,000 years or 2,000 years or however long it was since people crossed that land bridge from Asia, right? And to me as a kid, it was something that I never didn't love about living in the city, that I was in this world that was like then and now at the same time.
Yeah, it's a strange place that way. There's a lot of old theaters that are, that give you that feeling no matter when you walk in them, I think. Like Bob Baker, for sure, is someplace that, like, there's something that's spooky about it to me, but I like it.
This is a marionette theater in Los Angeles, famous children's marionette theater in Los Angeles that is profoundly spooky. I've seen their shows a number of times and found them to be distinctly spooky.
Yeah, I think I saw somebody saying they have their show at, like, a show at Knott's Berry Farm now, and there's something really fitting about those two things going together.
Well, Elizabeth Ito, your show is so beautiful, and I love it so much. I'm so glad that I got to see it and my kids got to see it. So thank you for taking all this time to be on Bullseye.
Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth Ito. Congratulations to her and the rest of the team that made City of Ghosts for their Peabody Award. It could not have been more well-deserved. If you haven't seen City of Ghosts, you can watch it on Netflix. Also, be on the lookout for Elizabeth's new short, Mall Stories. It's an animated documentary in a similar style to City of Ghosts. The voices of all the characters are real people that work at the Mongolian Grill in the Burbank Mall. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. Although this week, I am actually recording from my friend's guest bedroom in Woodside, California, where I have gone to the Antiques Roadshow. Thank you so much to the Roadshow for inviting me. I had such a great time visiting with my mom. We met some of our favorite appraisers on that program. I had a great time in the Filoli Sculpture Gardens. Now, I will say that I forgot to bring headphones with me on this trip, and so I have borrowed some from my friend's four-year-old daughter. They are tiger-themed. They're orange, and they have little tiger ears on them. I am recording this right now on video, and we will share that on social media, so make sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter if you want to see me making an NPR show in children's tiger headphones. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellow at Maximum Fun is Tabitha Myers. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Our interstitial music is by Dan Wally, also known as DJW. Our theme music is by the Go Team. It's called Huddle Formation. Our thanks to the Go Team and thanks to their label, Memphis Industries, for letting us use that. Bullseye is also on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. You can find us there, give us a follow, and we'll share with you all of our interviews and the aforementioned picture of me wearing little orange children's tiger headphones. I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Allianz Travel Insurance. With benefits kicking in as close as 100 miles from home, you can protect your travel plans whether you're driving across state lines or flying cross-country. Learn more at AllianzTravelInsurance.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
It's a high-stakes election year, so it's not enough to just follow along. You need to understand what's happening so you are fully informed come November. Every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast, our political reporters break down important stories and backstories from the campaign trail so you understand why it matters to you. Listen to the NPR Politics Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.